And Larry is another of those preachers that's a great song leader. I won't say I envy them, but I wish I had been able to do a lot better. And I love your singing, Larry. You have a tremendous voice. Here I stand on a pulpit, behind a pulpit stand, on high, and Jesus sat down just about every time he ever talked. I almost feel guilty when we stand up and look down on the people. But of course, we have a different culture in this day and time, and then we have all of these electronic things. I appreciate your presence this morning, and I'm going to ask you to turn to the 7th chapter of the book of Acts. 7th chapter of the book of Acts. And Stan told me this was a Bible study class, so if I didn't want to preach a sermon, among my sermons, I could do something else, and so I've chosen to do something else. But Lord willing, the lesson tonight will be a sermon on unselfishness. And probably the last service of the meeting, Thursday night, I'm going to talk about the tendency to fall. I'm talking about the tendency of those who serve God and the tendency of God's people as a whole, or the tendency of congregations to fall away. The tendency to fall. In Acts chapter 7, we have Stephen's defense. We have his apology or his answer to the charges that were made against him, and actually he's not answering those charges. You'll notice that in chapter 6, verses 12 through 14, that we're told that they stirred up the people and the elders and the scribes and came upon him and seized him and brought him into the council. And in verse 11, they had already suborned, and that simply means they hired them. They called upon them to tell lies. They suborned men who said, and then they made charges against him. And so now they've stirred up the people as the result of that, and the elders and the scribes came upon him and seized him and brought him into the council and set up false witnesses who said, "This man ceaseth not to speak words against this holy place and the law. For we've heard him say that this Jesus of Nazareth shall destroy this place and shall change the customs which Moses delivered unto us." I'm not going to waste my time or your time by trying to figure out what Stephen might have said that caused them to say this, because in the first place we're told they had suborned men, and that's underhanded and conniving. And also we have nothing more than false witnesses, and he's not interested in even responding to those men. He doesn't respond to the so-called witnesses who were false witnesses. What Stephen does instead was to give a concise review of the history of the Israelites from the time of Abraham, where he begins, down to the time of Solomon, who built the temple. But in the process, he also quotes from Amos. And Amos was a prophet of God long after Solomon, in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah, and Jeroboam II, who was a king of Israel. And he also quotes from Isaiah. And Isaiah was a prophet around 750 B.C. His purpose was to show them that as your fathers did, so also do ye. And so he deliberately goes over this history. And I'm convinced that as he began and continued at first, he had their attention. They were very proud of their history. They were very, very proud of all of the things that he had brought out in that history, beginning with Abraham and coming down to the time of Solomon. And so they may have kind of relaxed a little bit when that was done. They were very proud people in regard to that history. God's chosen people. The only people to whom God had given a written law. They were very proud of Moses the lawgiver. Of course, they were not proud of him in his day, but they were long after his day. And so we have Stephen giving this concise depiction of their history, and concise it really is. You might look at verse 12 when he says, "But when Jacob heard that there was grain in Egypt, he sent forth our fathers the first time, and at the second time Joseph was made known to his brethren." Now, How would you describe the two visits of the brothers of Joseph? You wouldn't do it that way. I wouldn't do it that way. I could not resist the temptation to give more details than that. And so he simply says there was the first time they went down, and then Joseph made himself known to his brothers the second time. There's a lot of history here that's just condensed together. But of course his purpose really is to indict the people before him. The false witnesses, the members of the Sanhedrin, those who had opposed him in the synagogues where he had taught. And so he begins actually to do this in verse 39. Notice in verse 39 that Stephen says, "To whom our fathers would not be obedient, but thrust him from them and turned back in their hearts unto Egypt." And so everything sounds good until that point. And he says, "Remember how our fathers behaved there at Mount Sinai when they worshiped the calf of gold and wanted to go back to Egypt?" And so he begins that part of it. And that's really what he's emphasizing here. And we finally get to verses 51 through 53. And this is what so angered them. "Ye stiff-necked and uncircumcised in heart and ears, ye do always resist the Holy Spirit. As your fathers did, so do ye. Which of the prophets did not your fathers persecute? And they killed them that showed before of the coming of the righteous one, of whom ye have now become betrayers and murderers. Ye who received the law as it was ordained by angels and kept it not." And that's the end of it. Maybe they stopped him right there. But you'll notice that when they heard these things, they were cut to the heart and gnashed on him with their teeth. And soon they'll be stopping up their ears. And then soon they will be taking him out and stoning him to death. Now, you haven't guessed yet my purpose in the lesson this morning. We need to know that background. And it's wonderful that this man was willing to lay down his life for the gospel and the souls of men. The first recorded martyr, Stephen, one of the seven. But the purpose of my going over this is to deal with the fact that way back there, a man wrote a book called The Mistakes of Moses. And I remember my father referring to that in his sermons. And he said, imagine a man in this day and time looking back that far to the time of Moses, and then picking at the books that he wrote, Genesis through Deuteronomy, and writing about the mistakes of Moses. Well, if they were the mistakes of Moses, they were the mistakes of God. God doesn't make mistakes. And so, of course, it was an unfair book, an unjust book. He did not try to fairly handle the record. Well, men also, various skeptics, agnostics, atheists, have pounced upon this defense of Stephen, and they've talked about the mistakes of Stephen in this speech. So that's what I want to talk about. And this might help you in dealing and talking to your children, because they are exposed to the idea that the Bible is a book of myths, a book of legends, a book telling stories about characters that never existed, a book that makes up things that never happened. And then they charge the Bible with all kinds of contradictions. And we've made frequently the blanket statement that invariably you will have even archaeologists, scientists, pointing out a so-called error in the Bible, and it's simply because they don't have all the facts yet. And one day they'll discover some facts that will show they were in error and the Bible was correct. We know this. We've said this to them. But we need to be able to give them specific details, and you can do that with many archaeological finds. But I want to direct your attention to these so-called five mistakes of Stephen. First of all, they say he contradicted Moses as to where and when God called Abraham. So let's read chapter 7 of Acts, verses 2 through 4, and see what Stephen says about it. He said, "Brethren and fathers, hearken." He had a lot of respect for these wicked men. Brethren and fathers, they're Jewish brethren, and fathers out of respect. "The God of God of glory appeared unto our father Abraham when he was in Mesopotamia." The word means between the rivers, the Tigris, the Euphrates, and it can be used of any of that area. up high or low, any of the land between the two rivers. This is the lower part of the land between the two rivers. Notice, before he dwelt in Haran. And so from the place that he's calling Mesopotamia, he goes to another place that's called Haran, and said unto him, get thee out of thy land and from thy kindred, and come into the land which I will show thee. And then came he out of the land of the Chaldeans, and that's Ur of Chaldees, or Ur of the Chaldeans, remember the city that where he lived, and dwelt in Haran. And from thence, when his father was dead, God removed him into this land wherein you now dwell. And so they say, there's mistake number one. According to Moses in Genesis, God called him when he was at Haran. According to Stephen, oh no, God called him before he dwelt in Haran. Contradiction? Well, couldn't God call him twice? Couldn't God have called him in both places? And is there even the semblance of a contradiction here? Notice that he says, after God called him from Mesopotamia, from the land of the Chaldeans, before he dwelt in Haran, notice that he says that God called him into the land, that after he went into the land of Haran, that from thence, from there, from Haran, when his father was dead, God removed him. God removed him. How did God remove him? Well, he called him again. He appeared to him again. So you actually have the two right here. And that is no contradiction. If you'll simply add what Moses wrote to this, you have the two calls. So in Acts 7, verses 2 through 4, it is Stephen who gives the details of the call at Ur of Chaldees. And we've emphasized that so much that sometimes we may think that when we're reading the account in Genesis, that we're reading about the call of God to Abraham from Ur of Chaldees, which is really not the case. So let's go over to Genesis. So from Acts chapter 7, let's go to Genesis chapter 11. And in Genesis chapter 11, we read first of all verse 31. And verse 31 says, Terah, that's his father, took Abram his son, and Lot, the son of Haran, his son's son, and Sarai, that's the pronunciation the American Standard gives it, Sarai, I think the King James, his daughter-in-law, his son Abram's wife, and they went forth with them from Ur of the Chaldees. Now why did they leave? Why did they leave? Well, according to Stephen, God appeared to him and called him. That's why. We have the words of God to him. And so they went forth from Ur of the Chaldees to go into the land of Canaan. And by the way, notice that. Moses is writing this. And of course, when Moses wrote this, he knew exactly where God had in mind. Now, when Abraham was called, God said, go into a land that I will show thee. Abraham went out not knowing whither he went. Hebrews 11, 8 and 9. He went out by faith. And so God is leading the way. Why did he go from Ur of Chaldees to Haran, which is not directly in the line to the land of Canaan? Well, of course, there was a great desert there, and usually they travel that way. They would go up over that desert and then back down. North, west, then south, west, they would go to the land of Canaan. But Moses, of course, writing in his time, is writing long after this fact. And Abraham had come and lived and died in that land of Canaan. And so he could write that he went from Ur of Chaldees to go into the land of Canaan, because that's what God had in mind. And they came unto Haran and dwelt there. And so notice that we have Abraham, Abram as he's known at this time, in the land of Haran. Now, I'll skip over verse 32, and we're going to come back to it later for another so-called mistake. Chapter 12. Now Jehovah said unto Abram, where is he? He's at Haran. He's not at Ur of Chaldees. Now Jehovah said unto Abram, get thee out of thy country and from thy kindred. This has become his country now. And his kindred there. In fact, more are there than are named. No mention is made of his brother Nahor going with them. Terah took. Nahor's not mentioned. But you do remember Rebekah, the daughter of Bethuel, Bethuel, the son of Nahor. And you remember also her brother Laban. And Laban had two daughters, and remember Rachel and Leah. And they were all living in this same place. Not only is it called Haran, it's all called Padan Aram and other names as well. So Jehovah said unto Abram, get thee out of thy country, from thy kindred, from thy father's house, unto the land that I will show thee. So he still doesn't know the destination. But Moses has already told us that he came out of Ur of Chaldees to go to Canaan, because Moses is writing long after the fact. Unto a land that I will show thee, verse 2, and I will make of thee a great nation. I will bless thee and make thy name great, and be thou a blessing. And I will bless them that bless thee, and him that curseth thee will I curse. And in thee, and we know that out of all of the promises, this was the most important. This was the spiritual promise of salvation and Christ, a lineal descendant of Abraham. In thee shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Later it's in thy seed every time it's mentioned. So Abram went, verse 4, as Jehovah had spoken unto him, and Lot went with him, and Abram was 75 years old when he departed out of what? Haran. So is there a contradiction? No, there's not a contradiction. God simply called Abraham twice. Well, not only do we have that, one more verse, look at chapter 15. Genesis chapter 15 and verse 7. And he said unto him, and this is on the occasion when he had told him to look at the stars and number them. Are you able to number them? So shall thy seed be. And he believed God, and it was reckoned unto him for righteousness. Verse 6. And he said unto him, I am Jehovah that brought thee out of what? Brought thee out of Ur of the Chaldees to give thee this land to inherit thee. So there you have it. Moses tells us that God brought him out of Ur of the Chaldees. And God appeared to him at Haran, and he gives the very words that God spoke to him there. And notice that in that case at Haran, he said, and from thy father's house. And Terah, his father, had gone. In fact, it says Terah took and Terah went. So we do not have a contradiction there. Contradiction or mistake number 2. They say he and Moses are confused as to when Abraham left Haran. Look at Acts 7 and 4 once more. Acts chapter 7 and verse 4. Then came he out of the land of the Chaldeans, dwelt in Haran, and from thence, from there, when his father was dead, God removed him into this land wherein you now dwell. And they say evidently Stephen got confused and couldn't do good math, and therefore we have another mistake here. Well, why do they say that? Well, they go to Genesis 11 and verse 26. And it says, Terah lived 70 years and begat Abram, Nahor, and Haran. So they assume that means that Terah was 70 years old when Abram was born. All right. He left Haran after his father died. Right? That's what Stephen tells us. When his father was dead, God removed him. How old was Abraham when he went into the land? Well, we read that also in Genesis 12 and verse 4. Abram was 75 years old when he departed out of Abraham. We can do the math. 70 plus 75 equals 145. And he left Haran after his father had died. And so Haran could not have lived any more than 145 years. Uh-oh. Look at the last verse of Genesis chapter 11. And the days of Terah were 205 years, and Terah died in Haran. Well, he missed it by 60 years or more. And so after he left Haran, his father actually was still living and didn't die until sometime later. So that's mistake number 2. Mistake? All right, look again. Do you think that Moses is telling us that when Terah reached the age of 70, he had triplets? And those were Abram, Nahor, and Haran. I don't even believe they're listed in the order of their birth. They're listed in the order of their importance. Abram is the chief character. Abram becomes Abraham. He's the father of the Jews. And not Nahor, not Haran. And let me compare this with something else. And this is back in the book of Genesis chapter 5, all the way back in chapter 5, verse 32. Genesis 5:32, Noah was 500 years old, and his wife gave birth to triplets, it says. No, that's not what it says. It says in Noah, he begat Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Does that mean when he reached the age of 75, 500 in this case, that these three sons were born? Well, we know from other details that's not the case at all, from other figures given. This was the beginning. This was the beginning. And it's probably given in approximate numbers. But it certainly does not mean that they were triplets and they were all born at the time that Noah was 500 years old. So there's a similar thing. And I do not know that this is the order of their birth, but I do know that Shem's the most important, because it's from Shem that we receive the line of Christ. We receive the line of the Israelites. Shem, not Ham, not Japheth. So we go back to Genesis 11 and verse 26, and we look a little more. And notice verse 27. Now these are the generations of Terah. Terah begat Abram, Nahor, and Haran. Now they're mentioned in that order. I still believe it's not the chronological order. I believe that Haran, according to the record, was much older than the others. And Abram is mentioned first because of his importance. And Haran died. Uh-oh, there's one dying. Well, I believe he was the first one to be born, and they were born over a long period of time. In fact, if you do the math, he was up in years at the time that Abraham was born, because you take that 205 and you look at it from that standpoint of his death. He wasn't 145, he was 205. So he certainly wasn't 70 years old when Abraham was born. He was much older than that. And there is no contradiction there. So let's begin. Keep reading now. Back in Genesis 11, Terah begat Abram, Nahor, and Haran. And Haran begat Lot. And Haran died before his father Terah in the land of his nativity in Ur of the Chaldees. And Abram and Nahor took them wives. The name of Abram's wife was Sarai. We won't go into that. Half-sister, and he explains it later. And the name of Nahor's wife, Milcah, the daughter of Haran. Oh. Well, if you marry your brother's daughter, evidently, you're not real close to the same age. Your brother's probably quite a bit older than you, which would make possible the daughter being closer to your age, and that would make a whole lot more sense. And besides, the father of this daughter Milcah has died there in the land before Terah and the others even leave there. So we go ahead with the reading. The name of Nahor's wife, Milcah, the daughter of Haran, the father of Milcah, and the father of Iscah. And if you'll keep reading, verse 31, Lot, the son of Haran, he's also the father of Lot. And Lot, to me, seems to be close to the age of Abraham. Lot had two daughters long before Abraham had any children. Lot has two daughters there in the city of Sodom. And they were of marriageable age. And so when you look at all of that, they're picking at one verse. And that one verse is Genesis 11, verse 26. And they're trying to do the math from there. And so they say, behold, we have a contradiction. Now, when you consider the rest of the story, and God always answers the infidel or the skeptic. Brother Roy Cogdell used to say that every false doctrine was anticipated by God, and there's usually, especially one passage, that will show the fallacy of that doctrine. And then he would illustrate. Well, we're giving some here. All right. Let's look now at mistake number three. Well, along with this, we might add this one. I don't recall their saying anything about this one, but in verse 6 of Acts chapter 7, in verse 6, and God spake on this wise, that his seed should sojourn in a strange land, and that they should bring them into bondage and treat them ill 400 years. You can compare that with what God had said back there in Genesis 15 also, in regard to having descendants before Isaac was born, having descendants and they're being made slaves, and a numbers given. Make a note of Galatians chapter 3 and verse 17. In Galatians 3:17, the Apostle Paul gives a definite number from the time that God made the promise to bless all nations in Abram's seed or Abraham's seed to the time that the law of Moses was given, and the number is 430 years. And so however you want to take Genesis 15 or this statement in Acts 7 and verse 6, they were not slaves for 400 years. But it was about 400 years after God said this to Abraham that they would come out of the bondage in Egypt. All right, mistake number three. Infidels and other doubters, atheists, skeptics, agnostics say, and we'll throw in with that liberal theologians. They love to do this too. Stephen was wrong in the number of souls that came into Egypt from Canaan, Acts 7 and verse 14. In Acts chapter 7 and verse 14, Joseph sent and called to him Jacob his father and all his kindred, 315 souls. So that's 75. Now let's go back to Genesis and see what we have there. And we'll go to Genesis chapter 46. And in Genesis 46, we'll read verses 26 and 27. Genesis 46, 26 and 27. And all the souls that came with Jacob into Egypt that came out of his loins, besides Jacob's sons' wives, all the souls were 66. And the sons, that's 66 then. And the sons of Joseph who were born to him in Egypt, there were two souls. All the souls of the house of Jacob that came into Egypt were 110. And so in the record there, Moses is counting the 66. But add to that Joseph, who had already gone down there and was given a wife there, and she gave birth to two sons there, and you add the four to the 66, and you come up with the 70. Now, how are you going to handle that, they say? You've got Stephen saying 75, you've got Moses saying 70. Well, here would be my answer to that, and I do not take credit for all of this. Most preachers cannot do that because they do a lot of reading, and there are a lot of good people who've gone on before them, and they've already looked at all of these things. All of these have been answered. Everything that I've been saying to you has already been said who knows how many times. But maybe you haven't heard it, and I hope that I'm talking to someone that this might benefit, and you can use it in teaching and talking to others. But they call this a contradiction. Well, let's see if we can answer that one. Stephen was not a Hebrew Jew, but he was a Hellenistic Jew. Remember the controversy before this, back there in Acts chapter 6. And we have the Grecian Jews, or the Hellenistic Jews, complaining because their widows were neglected in the daily ministration. And so the apostles call the multitude of the disciples together, and they say, choose out seven men. And then they give the qualifications that they must meet. And they say, we will appoint these men over this business. And we're given the names of the men in verse 5. And in verse 5, when the men are named, we realize that all of those names are Greek names. All of them. All of them. And we know the meanings of all of those Greek words. Stephen, for example, means crown. And Philip, lover of horses, and so on all through the list. So Stephen was chosen, and it's remarkable that nobody objected to this, even the Hebrew Jews. They were all Jews, but the Grecian Jews had been highly influenced by Greek culture, and we won't go into that. Don't need to waste your time with that. But if you have a question about this, I'd be glad to deal with the question. But they chose men who were all counted as Grecian Jews. And that shows that we trust them. They're offended. They object. They say their widows are being neglected. Well, we'll let some that they would count as among them to take care of this business. And they will be taking care of the daily ministration. All right, notice where Stephen preached. And so we go now to chapter 6 of Acts, and began at verse 8, Stephen, full of grace and power, wrought great wonders and signs among the people. And remember, the apostles laid hands on these seven men, and five of them are then never mentioned again. Two of them are Stephen and Philip, both of them preaching by the Spirit, both of them able to perform miracles by the Spirit. The miracles confirm the message. Stephen, full of grace and power, wrought great wonders and signs among the people. But there arose certain of them that were of the synagogue, called the synagogue of the Libertines. That's the freedmen, those who had been slaves. And many Jews had been slaves. And of the Cyrenians and of the Alexandrians, those from Cyrene in northern Africa, Alexandria, northern Africa, northern Egypt, and of them of Cilicia, and this was the home of Barnabas, remember? This was the home of Saul of Tarsus, Tarsus of Cilicia. And Saul was brought up in a city where you would have Grecian Jews. So who are these people in either this synagogue, if there's only one, and many of the scholars of the language at least believe that there were probably more synagogues than one that these various ones assembled in. But all of these are Grecian Jews. Stephen is a Grecian Jew. Now, question. What version of the scriptures, the Old Testament scriptures, the Jewish scriptures, would they use? And the answer to that is they use the Septuagint. In fact, the New Testament has been revealed to us in Koine Greek, as you know. You've probably heard that until you've gotten tired of it from preachers, or maybe some preachers like me. And so God chose the Greek language. And about 250 B.C., roundabout, you have the translation called the Septuagint, from a Greek word meaning 70. They think that about 70 scholars made the translation from Hebrew into Greek. And in the Septuagint of Genesis 46, it says 75. And in verse 20, they give additional names. In verse 20, they give additional names that will total the 75. And so if you were making your defense, and you'd been quarreling with, contending with, and preaching the truth, these Grecian Jews in the synagogues who could not withstand the wisdom with which you spoke, and Stephen spoke by the Holy Spirit, what translation or what version or what account of the Old Testament scriptures would you use? And the answer is the Septuagint. And that translation says 75. I have no problem then with that. That takes care of mistake number three. Mistake number four. Mistake number four, they say, is when they say Abraham bought the land near the city of Shechem. And they say he did no such thing. He bought land near the city of Hebron. And it was Jacob who, afterward Abraham, bought land near Shechem. And they were about more than 50 miles apart. And so he made a mistake there. So let's look at Acts 7 once more. Acts chapter 7 and verses 15 and 16. And Jacob went down into Egypt, and he died himself and our fathers, and they were carried over unto Shechem and laid in the tomb that Abraham bought for a price of silver of the sons of Hamor in Shechem. And they say, why? It was Jacob that bought that land. Abraham bought the cave of Machpelah and the field that was adjacent to it of Ephron the Hittite. And you have one account in Genesis 23. So look at Genesis chapter 23. And we have the story of the death of his wife, Abraham's wife, Sarah, now. And in verse 17 of Genesis 23, so the field of Ephron, which was in Machpelah, which was before Mamre, remember the oaks of Mamre, the field and the cave which was therein, and all the trees that were in the field that were in all the border thereof round about, were made sure unto Abraham for possession in the presence of the children of Heth, the Hittites. before all that went in at the gate of his city. And after this, Abraham buried Sarah, his wife, in the cave of the field of Machpelah before Mamre, the same as Hebron, in the land of Canaan. And the field and the cave that is therein was made sure unto Abraham for a possession of a burying place by the children of Heth. And of course it was used not only for the burial of Sarah, but it was used as well for the burial of others. And the Bible identifies those. Now let's go to Genesis chapter 33. Genesis chapter 33, and so this is later, we read of the purchase of this land near the city of Shechem. Genesis 33, verses 18 through 20. And Jacob came in peace to the city of Shechem, which is in the land of Canaan, when he came from Padan Aram, and encamped before the city. Remember, he had gone to Padan Aram to find a wife. And God favored and blessed him, and he came back two companies. He went alone. He came back two companies. He bought the parcel of the ground which he had spread, where he had spread his tent, at the hand of the children of Hamor, Shechem's father, for 100 pieces of money. And he erected there an altar, and he called it, and the word means God, the God of Israel. So, yes, it's true that even Moses makes it very clear that Abraham bought a place near Hebron, and that his grandson Jacob bought a place near the city of Shechem. So now we go back to Genesis chapter 7 and look at what Stephen said here. We also know that Jacob was certainly not buried there at Shechem. Jacob, in fact, was buried in the cave of Machpelah. And if you want to make a note of the places where this information comes out, we have all of this. If I wrote it all down, that is, we have all of this. Well, whatever the case, remember the story of Jacob and all of those going into Egypt, the 75 or the 70. Jacob lives there till he dies, but he does not want to be buried there. And he not only goes with relatives, but he also goes with a great guard from Pharaoh, and they bury him in the cave of Machpelah. So we know that Jacob was buried there. And we know from Jacob that others were buried there. We know that Abraham was buried there when he died. We know also that Rebekah was buried there. Isaac was buried there. Leah was buried there. Deborah, the nurse of Leo, was buried there. And then, of course, Jacob himself, the last that we have recorded. And then way down the line, Joseph's going to be buried somewhere. Remember, he was embalmed, and they carried him for 40 years in the wilderness before they got to the land of Canaan. They had to keep his body in Egypt, carry it through the wilderness, and finally bury the body of Joseph. And we're told where the body of Joseph, or the remains of Joseph, the embalmed remains of Joseph, were buried. But what about the contradiction that they say is found right here in Acts chapter 7? All right, look again. In Acts 7, verses 15 and 16, Jacob went down into Egypt, and he died, himself and our fathers, and they were carried over unto Shechem, and laid in the tomb that Abraham bought for a price in silver of the sons of Hamor in Shechem. All right, let's read that like this. First of all, and Jacob went down into Egypt, and he died himself, and our fathers died. And they, our fathers, who would the fathers be? Well, they would be the brothers of Joseph, the brothers of Joseph. They all went down into Egypt, and they all died in Egypt, but they were buried here near Shechem. And so that would take care of that. He's not necessarily saying that Jacob was buried there near Shechem, but our fathers who died were buried there. All right? But it still says Abraham purchased this land. Well, it's possible that the name of Jacob was there, and as a result of copying by various scribes, the name of Abraham was substituted, and they looked at it that way. We have mistakes in some of the manuscripts, but they're all minor things like that. But that may not be the case at all. You can look at it one other way, and so let me suggest one other thing. Let's go to the book of Hebrews. What a strange place to go for that. Hebrews chapter 7. Hebrews chapter 7. And let me find the place. Hebrews 7 verses 9 and 10. Remember the discussion about Melchizedek and how that Abraham went after those captives that were taken when Lot and his family were taken from Sodom. And of course, the kings of the east defeated the kings of the west, and they took captives and spoil, including Lot and his family. Abraham raised an army and went after them, defeated them with the help of God, defeated them, brought back the captives and the spoil, and was met by Melchizedek, this prince of God Most High, this king of Salem, this high priest. And Christ is discussed as a high priest after the order of Melchizedek. And Abraham gave a tenth of the spoil to that high priest Melchizedek. And what's the point of bringing this out? Well, of course, he wants to emphasize the fact that Christ is a high priest not after the order of Aaron or the Levitical order, but he's a high priest after the order of Melchizedek. He had no predecessor. He has no successor. Look at verses 9 and 10 of Hebrews chapter 7. And so to say, through Abraham, even Levi, and that would be the Levites that descended from the man Levi, because when this took place, that is when the Levites received tithes, Levi has been long dead. And so through Abraham, even Levi, who receiveth tithes. Now, he received tithes after the law was given, and you have the Levites in place and assigned their duties, and the people are to bring their tithes to the Levites, and the Levites will give a tithe of that to those who were serving as high priests and priests. And so to say, through Abraham, even Levi, who received the tithes, hath paid tithes, for he was yet in the loins of his father when Melchizedek met him. That's an unusual passage. And it, of course, happened a long time before the Israelites began to bring their tithes to the Levites, who descended from the man Levi. And Levi is one of the sons of Jacob. And you have the tribe of Levi descending from him, the priestly tribe. And it's a rather unusual statement, but he says, in a sense, since they descended from Abraham, who was the father of Isaac, Jacob, Israel, and therefore all of the Levites, that they were actually giving tithes, the ones that would receive tithes were giving tithes back there to someone who was superior. And you give tithes to one who's greater. Melchizedek was the greater. He was the high priest of God, Most High. Christ a high priest after that order. So it's rather an unusual statement, but we understand what he's saying. And we can't disagree with him. In what sense could we ever say that Abraham purchased a field? Well, it was his grandson that bought it, but after all, that was his relative. And it became a possession of the people from then on. When Jacob died, they didn't take it away. It remained a possession. And the same is true of the field that Abraham had bought. And so I see no problem. Either we have a scribal era and Abraham became Jacob in the text, or this other would also explain it, and you would have no contradiction. So Jacob died, but he wasn't buried in this place. We're told that the fathers, and now those are the brothers of Joseph, that they also died, and they were buried. We're not told anywhere else in Genesis where those various brothers of Joseph died and were buried. We're not told about that, but we know they came down into Egypt and they lived there long enough to die. And the Israelites, of course, were brought into slavery after this and so on, with the story continuing. So that takes care of mistake number four. And then, briefly, mistake number five. Well, we've handled two of them together. I have these labeled separately. First, Stephen was wrong in who bought the land, so we've addressed that. And mistake number five, Stephen was wrong again about Jacob being buried in the land near Shechem, for he was buried in the cave of Machpelah. And it's there I have the verses. If you want those, that's where I'd written them down. All of this was done late last night after we went back to the room. Genesis 25, verses 9 and 10 will tell you about someone being buried there, the purchase of the field. Genesis 49, 29 through 32. And our time is gone, so I'm not going to keep you anymore if you want to write down the passages. But Genesis 25, verses 9 and 10. Genesis 49, verses 29 through 32. Jacob is speaking. Genesis 50 and verse 13. And that has to do with the death of Jacob and where he was buried. And so we have no contradictions. And thus the glaring contradictions all disappear. Now this is typical of the way that skeptics and atheists deal with the scriptures. They're unfair. They do not give the record the benefit of any doubt. If they can read an apparent contradiction into it, they do that. But they do not right that way, and they do not want to be read that way. Their own books are not like that. It's almost like this higher criticism, a special science to be applied only to the Bible. And they have their own rules for it. And they wouldn't dare apply it to other works until it happened to have been done in a case in Canada. And there you have a woman suing a publishing house because she said H.G. Wells, who had come out with a book by that publishing house, her manuscript was there at the same time, and it was printed later, and he stole from her material, and she was suing and getting nowhere. And they suggested that you contact this Reverend Dr. So-and-so, who was a specialist in higher criticism, and they said this man would be able to apply it to modern works. And so he did. He tried it. He used the rules they apply to the Bible. And they dismissed it, and it went to another court, and they dismissed it, and it went to the highest court, the Lords of the Privy Council in Canada, and they called it utter nonsense and insult to our intelligence, and they threw it out of court. And so that's the way it is with the so-called mistakes of Moses and the so-called mistakes of Stephen. I appreciate your patient attention. Hope this helps a little bit. And I say all of this so that we will make sure we're helping our children, our young people, in their education in God's Word, and they're facing a wicked world. We'll sing this song of encouragement, and if you are present needing to become a Christian, needing to obey the gospel from your heart, or needing to make correction of sin, would you come as we stand and while we sing?